Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Bretton Cliff's Flea Circus. My name is Cliff.
Hello, and I'm Minister Refuses to Apologise.
Okay, you're not alone there. Quite a few of you.
No, there's quite, I'm always on the telly, mate.
Yeah. What are you not apologising for this time?
Anything. COVID, dogs, deaths,
yeah.
Happiness, anything.
You could have avoided like 1,000 deaths or more.
Well, I refuse to apologise. So there you go.
Fair enough.
What are you going to do about it? I'm Teflon.
Before we get going properly, I just wanted to say this will probably have to be fairly quick for two reasons. One, I cannot sit in this position for very long. And two, I forgot to charge the laptop up. So it's a race against the clock.
It is indeed. How long do you estimate we'll have?
I'd say 50 minutes. That's enough,
15.
15.
15. Oh, 50. Yeah, that enough. Should be all right.
Also, I think the song that we're going to play is like 7 minutes long. So, I mean, that'll take up some of the time.
It'll ramp it up.
That'll save us some talking.
It will indeed.
So, yeah, I am outside. It's daytime because I'm off work. Convalescent. Uh-huh. Is that the right word?
If you want. I would say recovering.
Recovering. Recuperating. Mm.
Recuperating, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
So what are you recuperating from, Mr. Cliff?
Well, this time last week when we did the podcast, I was about to go in for hernia surgery. And I'll warn you now, I might make some choice faces at you while we're doing this. And also, I might let out a few groans because it's still very painful.
Yeah,
so I spent the night in hospital after it was done. Tell you what, Brett, before I had this done, all I had was a little weird pain every now and then. Now I'm in absolute agony and I have been for about 5 days. So I'm not really sure if I made the right choice.
Well, that's it. Your pain. I couldn't piss for weeks after having my one that I told you about. So
The wobbly kidneys, that one.
Aye.
So you must have had the tube for that, right? Up the old Mr. Kinnish.
It was a camera inserted in.
Yeah, so the eye something of the was penis. In there. Yeah, so
something was. I didn't look.
So similarly, my Tobias Jug down there. He had something inserted into him, and they didn't warn us when I went for Jimmy Riddle the next day.
Yeah, how much it would sting.
Yeah, I was not prepared for it whatsoever. The woman nurse outside the door was like, "Are you all right in there?" I'm like, "No, what the fuck's going on?"
This. It's awful.
That's just because you had a tube in there. I was like, okay, well, no, but I didn't know that for a start.
Yeah.
And also, warn us about that because I started panicking like fuck because it was absolutely killing.
I wasn't warned about that either. It was a very quick process when I did it. And there was a fella who had just had it before me and he had tears in his eyes coming out. Yeah. Awful, awful stuff.
So he said,
you won't be able to ejaculate the semen very far anymore.
Okay. Well, I mean, I haven't tried yet because everything around that process seems quite delicate right now.
So, I wouldn't go for it yet.
I won't enter any competitions yet.
No.
they might be able to make like a film about us, like you know, like Kingpin or something, where I get slowly get back to me best, like an underdog story. I'll start doing like local
tournaments.
Contests and then make it up to the nationals or something.
You're doomed, man.
Yeah, so this is also the most I've talked for ages because I've just been at home alone watching telly and stuff, which, you know, is my favourite pastime. So that's been quite
good. It is. Well, that's good.
But yeah, so I've got three holes in my stomach where they cut in, got a camera in, and then the other two holes are where they sent the little robots in to do the work.
The nanobites.
Yeah, I'm not. And yeah, so it is better than it was then. Like, I genuinely thought I was never going to feel better. But obviously I do a bit. But yeah, it's painful. I'll go back to the doctors in 2 days from now so they can tell us how it's going. But yeah, it's weird because I can't sit down properly and I can't lie down and I can't get up. And
plus,
I can't walk.
You're in the house by yourself. Presumably you can't masturbate. Which would be the perfect thing to do when everybody's out.
It's like Chinese water torture. Are you allowed to say that?
It is. Yeah, it's like waterboard.
So what about you? You've been at work, getting on your rounds.
I've been at work. I'm enjoying work. Like apart from one thing, and that's the dogs.
Okay.
For some reason, dogs just hate us. They really hate us. Even
hate all postmen. Is it a myth or is it true?
I think it's true. It's definitely true. Even my own dog is looking at us with suspicion.
Oh, really?
In his
Do you
eye
have to get changed in the car before you get in?
not quite that. So what I've decided to do to get myself into the mind of the dogs and to try and understand why, you know, the dogs don't like us, I decided to do a bit of research on it. And I thought the perfect place was Pets for Homes website.
Okay.
So I did a little bit of research, and that's what it says, or this is what it says on the Pets for Homes website. Many dogs are perfectly fine with the approach of the postman. However, it is not uncommon for the postman to inadvertently become your dog's perceived arch nemesis.
Okay, so they're going to make a film about it.
They could make a film about it, could do. So that's not a very good start, is it?
No, without even trying, you're the arch nemesis of
arch-ne-
who knows how many dogs.
Exactly. So that's the first bit. The postman may not call every day, but they certainly return often enough for the dog's mind to view this as added insult to injury.
Honestly, I can't. A laughing really hurts.
Well, I'm sorry.
What's the injury?
Don't blame me.
But what's the injury?
Pets for Homes. That's what I say. The injury is that you keep turning up and they keep being aggressive to get you away from the door or whatever. Do you know what I mean? And then you've gone and I think the dog's thinking, I've done me job here. And then the next day you return with a big happy smile on your face.
All right, okay.
So there's that insult to injury there.
Presumably it's evened out with the number of housewives coming to the door in lingerie and negligence.
What about the Avon lady? Bet they don't bark at her or try and attack her. But there you go. But do they women with lingeries knock on your door, do they? Or do they just nick your
No,
food?
I mean, you know, one door there's an angry dog, the next door there's a bored housewife.
Swings and roundabouts. Dogs are animals that thrive on routine and even begin to predict the presence of the pro postman. So we've got dogs that can predict now.
If they thrive on routine, they should start enjoying it.
Exactly. That is not happening. That is not happening, Cliff. And it happily finishes off with an average of over 2,000 postal workers are bitten by dogs every year. So we've got that to look forward to.
Okay,
that's
amazing.
Really nice, isn't it?
Have you come up with any of your schemes to win them over yet?
I haven't, no, but I have a couple of people have told us that some of the postmen and women have dog treats in their pocket, just in case.
Oh, I think that's a good plan.
Do you think it's a good plan? I don't think I can bring myself to do anything like that. I'm just the type of person that would run away.
Yeah, and it doesn't help, does it? The amount of times I've run away from dogs and just been chased as a result.
that it doesn't help.
I've been pursued history.
By dogs in the past.
My history with dogs is a little bit like yours with bikes.
Yeah. Yeah, calamitous.
Calamitous, yeah. I've watched a lot of telly, like I said. Shall I run you through mm-hmm. some of the things that I've watched?
Yeah, do it.
What you think? There's a documentary about Rick James, the funk musician, called Bitchin', The Sound and Fury of Rick James.
Is it not called Me Massive Red Women's High Heels? Because that's what it should be called.
It's really good. It's produced by his daughter. So, you know, it goes into some of the bad stuff that he's done and his drug problems. And obviously he died as a result of that kind of stuff. So it doesn't shy away from that. But all of the things that he went to court for, which were torturing women, imprisoning women, beating women and stuff like that, they'd just all be like, yeah, but obviously he didn't really do that, did he? Because he's a nice guy. Like whatever he would do. So I would say it's very one-sided on that front, even though it covers it. But all of the people talking are like, yeah, but you know, he had his problems, but he wouldn't do that stuff.
Does it go into his infatuation with the Exorcist child Linda Blair?
No.
Do you not know about that?
No, it doesn't mention anything about that.
I'm sure after the Exorcist, well, I'm sure maybe she was a bit older, but she would have been. Otherwise, there would have been arrests. That's all I can say.
I think she went out
with Rick James for a while.
No, it doesn't mention that.
Does it not?
It mentions the mother of his first children and then who he got married to when he was going through all this court business. But yes, it's good.
Can I just stop you? It's behind you, Cliff. Is there a raccoon perched on the balcony there? Yes. Is it a very small raccoon just looking at us?
Very still as well.
Very still.
Yeah, it's a mop.
Well,
it's
what's it doing there? Oh, it's the mop, is it? Look like it had eyes. It still looks like it's eyes.
I can see what you think. Oh, you would think that, yeah. It's a mop made out of a dead raccoon.
It's a raccoon with a walking stick, one long walking stick.
I mean, it is. You'll be surprised that raccoon fur is surprisingly absorbent.
I am surprised by that.
I watched that Rick James thing. That was good. I watched in its entirety that Midnight Mass, Mike Flanagan's latest thing.
Is it any good?
Nope, not at all.
It's not, because I like Mike Flanagan, me.
I know you do. This is 7 episodes of... It's a good premise, but I think maybe what this guy's guilty of is trying to cover too much stuff into... It's big. It's kind of big topics, like existentialism, what happens when you die, what religion's right, what religion's wrong, the way people treat each other about religion and small communities and accepting others into the communities and people trying to leave and change themselves and ending up back there. And can you really escape where you're from and what you're born into and all of that kind of stuff. And vampires.
Well, he's a massive Stephen King fan, isn't he?
Yeah. So, you know what? It's 7 hours. I think if you had like 4 episodes, cut out a lot of there's parts where there's 2 people talking to each other for like 30 minutes, just 30 minutes going, what do you think when you die? Well, I think your atoms interchange with the air and you become one with the stars, blah, blah, blah. And just, and honestly, 20 minutes later, I'm thinking, is he still fucking going on about this? Like, it goes too much into trying to explain the stuff, I think. And I get why he's doing it. I've read a bit about it afterwards, and there's some good performances in it. You know the guy who's the FBI guy in Legion? He's a bit odd. Like, there's something quite odd about him. He is this new priest that turns up in this small island community. And miracles start happening. And then, you know, it unravels and you find out what the true story is and all of this kind of stuff. And it's meant to be about miracles and rebirth and God and all of this kind of stuff, and this angel's meant to be there helping them all. But I mean, it's obviously a vampire, but they never say it's a vampire.
Yeah,
but he's like,
yeah, well,
so there's a lot of good stuff in it, but honestly, like, if I wasn't off work and I had the ability to watch it all, I would probably have fallen away. But
so you're gonna watch that Manhunt thing?
Yeah, I can't bring myself to do it.
Oh, fair enough. Is that it?
Today I watched a documentary about the TV personality, food writer, travel kind of presenter Anthony Bourdain, who died a couple of years ago at his own hand. And
he's also into the drugs, wasn't he? I've seen a couple of things where he's taken acid and stuff like that.
Yeah, I love that guy. He's like a big inspiration for me as a writer and stuff. And I love and traveling and trying new things. But he's a guy who was kind of on a quest to always be pushing the boundaries and try something new. Nothing seemed to satisfy him. It's an incredibly poignant, infuriating, and brilliant documentary about a sporadically brilliant mind and presenter. And ultimately really sad because he kind of ran out of road, I think, rather than like, I think life still had lots to give him. And he still had good stuff to do, but he ran out of road, if we're going to use the title of the thing to, as a metaphor. But I would recommend it because there's some great stuff in it. If anybody likes him, even a little bit, it's worth watching. And also, I think anybody who's had kind of struggled with, you know, what they're doing in their life, or they know somebody who's thought about that and what their place in the world is and all of that kind of stuff.
Everybody struggles with that at some point.
Yeah, exactly, which is why I think it's really poignant. And there's some absolutely amazing music in there, because one of the things is he's a bit of a rock star for a chef and TV presenter. You know, he's like he was into the Ramones and all that kind of stuff. Absolutely superb soundtrack. So worth recommending.
Like Stephen King. Stephen King's favorite band.
Ramones. So yeah, that's what I'll be watching. A couple of the bits and pieces, but they're the three main things.
I haven't been watching anything. I've just been working and stuff like that.
Well, the other thing I've watched,
go on then,
is the 1957 Hammer movie, The Curse of Frankenstein.
Have you?
Yes. Goodness. Have you?
Well, so I did actually watch that, yes, for about the 700th time.
Okay.
So, yes, I've seen that one. I obviously love it, but it's the first time that you've seen it, I guess, is it?
Do you want to explain it a bit, and then I'll go into what we thought?
Yeah, so it's called The Curse of Frankenstein from 1957. It's a Hammer horror, which is a British company, obviously. It's loosely based on the 1880 novel by Mary Shelley, which is called Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus, which is its other title as well, which I like. Starring Peter Cushing as Baron Victor Frankenstein, Christopher Lee as the creature, and it's directed by Terence Fisher. And if you're a Hammer fan, you'll know all about Terence Fisher.
Yeah, I didn't really look into him. What else has he done?
Dracula after this. So like the two main ones and loads of other ones as well.
Okay.
But it's this just made stars of Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee as well. They were just massive stars after
this. Made a star of Christopher Lee after this, really?
Yeah, honestly, Yeah, I mean, I think Christopher Lee's great in this. I mean, he is the creature after all, and the creature just doesn't do much, really, apart from stalk people. He has got a nice jacket. Boris Karloff as well, he was a star of Frankenstein.
You read the Mary Shelley book?
I have. I would say it's one of my favourite books.
Okay.
To be honest. It's
a lot deeper than just a monster.
Massively.
Isn't it? It's not really about a man creating a monster.
It's about God and all kinds of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about playing God and really about men acting as God towards women and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And men rejecting that children and all kinds of revenge. It's just about loads of different stuff.
I think often, maybe I'm wrong, but I would imagine that the book is kind of forgotten about most of the time because the film or the character of Frankenstein's monster or the creature is so just ubiquitous, such a cultural touch point.
And visceral as well, isn't
it? Yeah, what it looks like and what it means in these films, that the actual book and the original meaning or intended meaning of the book is kind of long, long forgotten about by the majority of people, I would think.
Do you think? I'm not too sure about that, to be perfectly honest. I think it's obviously this I would have saw when I was very, very young. I would watch it with me mom, because we love the Hammer horror films and stuff like that. And it was always in my mind to read the book, even from a really, really young age. Obviously, it would have completely gone over my head if I had read it when I was, you know, 8 or, you know, even a little bit older than that. So I think I read it in my 20s and I just absolutely loved it. I thought it was amazing.
I suppose what I mean is, like, you know, you're watching Scooby-Doo and there's a Frankenstein and that. You can watch
a
pop music video.
It's iconic.
And there's a Frankenstein monster in some, like...
But I don't think the book's lost. I wouldn't say that. I don't think it's been... I think
it's still a classic
one of
text,
those,
I think is...
Yeah. It's also one of those that have been sort of analysed by scholars. I mean, there's people at universities and stuff like that, heads of literature who've made their names
on
the book.
I suppose what I mean is the monster has taken on a life of its own.
Definitely.
Outside of these films, outside of this storyline and outside of the book, I think it's what.
Yes. I agree with that, yeah. Uh-huh. But I don't think it's been lost.
So one thing I've noticed about these films, and something that I don't think is talked about enough anymore, is that old films used to have the credits at the beginning.
The credits are class, aren't they? Everything about the credits I love. The music.
I don't love
it. It's
music.
Just wonderful. Do you not?
And by the music, James Bernard. All the way through, the music absolutely does my head in.
Oh, I loved it. I loved the music. I mean, it's that kind of thing when you're a little kid or whatever, and you know, you're asleep in your bedroom and you hear that music from downstairs and you know that your mom and dad are watching a horror.
That type
of stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I love that, man. And the gothic font of the
All of that, how love that looks, it. I think is great. But yeah, the music is so over the top and melodramatic all the
but
way
that's
through.
That's the point.
So loud all the way through. We see at the beginning, Peter Cushing has Victor Frankenstein. He's been locked up and he's got a priest who's come to see him, and he's telling him, like, he's been arrested, we find out, for the murder of a young lady. And
yes, he's made.
And he's like, no, I didn't do that. I'll tell you what did happen, as if this is going to make him look any better. So he starts telling
the story.
It
doesn't make him look any better.
And we go back to him as a kid. His mom's just died. And he's a precocious young man, Baron Victor Frankenstein, who is now the heir to the Frankenstein fortune and a big spooky house.
And he's a bit of a twat.
He is, but I think he's brilliant. I genuinely think he's brilliant.
Peter Cushing kind of schooled him in how to walk and behave and stuff like that, take on his mannerisms and
Melvin
things.
Melvin Hayes. So, I remember being old, you know, when we were kids, he was still on stuff. He was like this kind of well-loved British actor, kind of entertainer. I think he's absolutely brilliant as the young, precocious Victor Frankenstein.
But he's so annoying.
Oh, no, he's horrible. He's horrible. Yeah. He's brilliant at it.
Yeah, he is.
And immediately after his mom's funeral, where his auntie is like, are you still going to send us that money that your mom sent us? And by the way, he has your cousin. You might want to marry her someday. And he's like, don't worry, I know all about it. See you later, see you later.
Yeah, I know Elizabeth, don't worry about that.
As soon as he gets rid of them, chap turns up at the door, Paul.
A chap who is employed to tutor him in the many ways of science and presumably, you know, lots of other stuff as well.
Yeah.
And he quite arrogantly says while he's narrating, and after 2 years, I'd learned everything that he had to teach us. After 2 years.
After 2 years. But keeps him around until he's about 40.
he's mate. Quite likes him and stuff. So he keeps him around, doesn't he? But I mean,
go on, sorry.
Peter Cushing. It is at the start when he's in the jail and stuff like that. Peter Cushing just looks great, doesn't he? Even though he's like disheveled and
yeah,
and stuff like that when he meets the priest. Because in the book, it's Frankenstein narrating it. There's a guy who he's sort of on a boat with and stuff like that. So it's similar, but it's not the same, obviously. And what Hammer were threatened with, because all this stuff, all the imagery of Frankenstein that everybody knew about Frankenstein, it was owned by Universal. So if they had copied anything or taken anything from the Universal films, they would have just been sued. So that meant that they had to sort of create their own thing.
Yeah.
Everything had to look different, you know what I mean?
That classic Frankenstein's monster image that we know, bolts on the necks and a big forehead, mm-hmm. and green and ragged clothes and all of that kind of stuff, that had already existed in film form from, I mean, there'd been loads of films by this point, Boris Karloff being the main actor, or the most successful actor of playing him by this point. So, yeah, this comes along, and like you say, it's different. So if you're expecting that, or if people went to see this expecting that, it's not like that at all.
For the better art.
Yeah, I think so. It's a lot more human.
For one, it's the first British horror film in colour. It's the first Frankenstein film in colour as well. Okay. And Hammer sort of used that to the advantage with the blood and the gore, don't they?
Because
people were really... I mean, you got 1957, you got to take yourself back to then. People wouldn't have seen the things that go on in this film at all, with blood squirting out of people's eyes and stuff like that. It really shocked people. Do you know what I mean? It made Hammer.
And you can see why. I mean, not only are the actors great in it, but the effects are great. And it's shot really well. It's just so evocative. The main thing, I think, is, you know, he's been studying for however long, 2 years plus all the rest that he didn't need. And he's trying to work out a way to bring life back to stuff. So he brings a little dog back to life and then moves on to, let's do it with a human.
But he's not happy with just creating. He's not happy with reanimating the dog, is he? He wants to create his own being.
Yeah.
That's what he wants to do.
But what do you think of the method of doing that?
Well, I think if the method of having multicolored bubbly liquids, right, is the perfect way to bring people back to life.
Honestly, like, I don't know what they spend all of their time learning, because all you do is looking, get some liquid bubbling away in various jars, and you're there.
Yeah. Again, it goes back to how they couldn't use the Universal stuff, because the Universal stuff, everything's electricity, isn't it? It's like Tesla coils and stuff like that. They couldn't do that. They couldn't, so they had to think of a different way. But Peter Cushing looks like he knows what he's doing, so I'm happy. Doesn't he? He's so good at that.
Bubbling liquid. But
he looks like he knows what he's doing with it.
Yeah, he's great. Like, he looks, he's learned it. He's like method. He's learned he's learned this skill. So that's really good. And then, you know, after he brings the dog back, they just, him and Paul start capering about with some dead bodies.
They do indeed. I mean, there's some great bit when it gets in. Again, going back to stuff that people wouldn't have seen before. There's a part, they get a highwayman who's been hanged and they cut him down and stuff like that. And Peter Cushing sort of says, well, I don't need the head. The eyes have been pecked out by birds.
Yeah.
They're the first to go all the time.
Paul's like, oh, bloody hell, the birds got there quickly. And he's like, we need the head. And just immediately chops his head off and puts it in a vat.
But you don't see him do it.
Rolls it in a vat of acid.
So it's like, you know what he's doing. You know what he's doing, cutting off the head
it's
and stuff
like
that.
More like on Paul's face,
and there's this subtle bit where he just gets his hand and rubs it on his wonderful jacket.
But he's got a lovely jacket. He should definitely have some overalls on.
He doesn't care,
does he? That's a great thing. Like, he's very well dressed, this guy. He's, you know, he's rich, he's a baron.
Mm-hmm.
And here he is wandering around, climbing up gallows to chop off, cut down highwaymen. He's just rubbing like the blood off this guy on his jacket, because all of that stuff is so immaterial to him at this point. You're only 20 minutes into the film or something, and he's already obsessed with bringing something to life, creating life of its own. So he chops the head off, he rolls it up in a little bag and puts it in a vat of acid. I think he could have put the fucking cloth in there as well, by the way. I don't know why he keeps the cloth.
No, he needs the cloth, man. Needs the cloth. I mean, what the other bits are like, pretty much after this. I mean, Elizabeth comes to stay, his cousin or whatever as well at this point. Mm-hmm. But he goes, well, I'm just going away for the weekend to Paul. He goes, where are you going? Oh, don't worry about me. I'll be back. And then he comes back. And he says to Paul, come on upstairs. I've got something to show you. Look at these pair of lovely beauties. And he's got a pair of hands.
Because when the body's on the slab at the beginning, before that, he's like, look at these hands. He's like really upset.
Useless, these hands.
Useless. He's upset with these big hands that the highwayman's got. So he goes off on a little mission to get a pair of hands. Then,
pair of hands?
Yeah, while he's
from
away,
a sculptor?
While he's away, Elizabeth comes back because her mom's now died. So, and she says, oh, we're going to get married, which is news to Paul. Paul, at this point, has realized he doesn't really want anything to do with creating this creature. And
initially, he's all for it, isn't he? He's all for it.
I wonder what he thought it would go like.
I don't know. Like, he keeps all the way through the film, he keeps going, oh, why don't you just stop it? Why don't you just stop what you're doing? It's folly.
Like you've had enough now, haven't you? I mean, you've chopped this guy's head off. Let's call it a day. That's enough, isn't it?
Let's call it a day. Why don't you just bring things back to life? Come on,
learned how to do that. Put them in a vat of water, make it bubble.
It's not good enough. It's not good enough for him. He wants to create his own man, doesn't he?
So then, next thing we know, so he's going out. Paul tries to warn Elizabeth off, and she's like, well, why would I leave? I'm getting married to him. And he's like, you can't get married not to your cousin, which is what he said.
No. Yeah.
You just can't get married to him because he's conducting some questionable experiments.
Yeah, he refuses to tell Elizabeth what's actually happening because a young female mind won't be able to take it. So then, and I love Peter Cushing's kind of excuses and stuff like that for doing all these. I haven't done anything wrong. I'm not harming anybody. Yeah. I've just robbed a few graves.
He's like, is that not what science is based on? Questioning, always trying to prove the new thing. Like, you're not like taking your very, very small bag out on a night to meet a fucking undertaker to get a lovely pair of eyes, which, by the way, don't match.
No. Some nice fresh ones here for you. Coffin man, who buys them?
That seems great because you just see the midriff. You see basically a transaction's being done on the top of a coffin between like a guy who I'm guessing is an undertaker or... He's wearing an apron, so presumably he's doing autopsies or postmortems or whatever. And he rocks up with these super small, it's like a tiny pool cue bag, isn't it, that he takes out of them to get these eyes. And you don't see his face, which is just a lovely touch, I think, that you just see like the transaction.
That's guy, all you see, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, really good.
It's class.
Anyway, then you find out that Cushing's actually got a nice bit on the side with the housemaid.
It comes from a bit where Elizabeth's kind of explaining that she's going to marry him and stuff like that, and he's the only one that she wants. And then immediately it sort of jumps to the next scene where Cushing's necking on with a maid and stuff. Wonderful bit.
Yeah, it's really good.
She's in Dracula, the next one, but she wasn't in anything after that, I don't think.
Oh, really? She's good. She's good.
She is good. She is good, aye. Valerie Gaunt.
So then Victor tries to get Paul on side yet again. So he's got him like covered up with a blanket, and he lifts the blanket up, and he obviously thinks Paul's going to be like, fucking hell, actually, yeah. Like,
that's amazing.
What was I thinking? Like, this is a great idea after all. And Paul just goes, it's horrible. It's horrible.
He does, doesn't he? And he just goes, oh, like that.
And he's going all that. He's like, he's going, the features are immaterial, Paul. Because once we put
the brain in,
and the brain will be of a brilliant mind. The features will follow. and he'll become a kindly looking face because it'll take on the aspect of the brain. What I love
I'm not sure about that science.
But what I love about this is all the time he's doing it, he keeps looking up at his head like he's talking to him. And he keeps like Peter Cushing's eyes keep flickering up, and he's
thinking
he's going to have his fucking brain out. Anyway, that isn't the plan. I just thought it was brilliant. He does it a couple of times. He just flicks his eyes up to his head while he.
Haven't noticed that before, but that's absolutely genius. That, like, I love that.
Honestly, I noticed it because I was thinking, oh shit, it's going to be him. But anyway, it's not. Then we meet the professor whose brain is going to be used, who comes in. Yeah. He's got a wonderful accent.
He has got a wonderful accent, and he's got the most brilliant brain in Europe, hasn't he? Yeah. And Paul doesn't even suspect anything, does he? Isn't it a coincidence that he's got the most brilliant mind in Europe into his house or whatever? But Cushion, it doesn't care, does he? He really doesn't care, because he just goes, all right, well, off to bed now. I'll take you upstairs, right? Oh, do you want to come and have a look at this picture? It's a lovely picture. Just move back a little bit, because you're at the top of the stairs. You'll see it better if you move back. Professor, watch out! And then he pushes him off the balcony. And the stunt man on this must be dead. Yeah, that's all I can see.
Because he lands flat on the top of his head.
He does. But quite literally, it's not a dummy or anything, it's a man.
No, it's a man.
And he lands on top of his head. You can see his neck and sort his of neck go back into his body.
Fucking hell. I'm like...
that man must have been dead.
The stunt man is injured, at least.
Yeah,
and also, definitely. This professor's brain might not be of much use anymore after that.
No. Plus, it's an odd way to fall, isn't it? I mean, if you were falling, you put your hands out in front of you, wouldn't you? It just doesn't... He just falls right on top of his head. It's unbelievable stuff.
I have to admit, after this point, I get quite bored of the film. Like, I like.
Oh,
this.
Dear.
Yeah, like it gets good again when the monster comes to life, but there's like.
Yeah.
I think there's a big bit where, I don't know, like he's just trying to put this brain in.
Yeah, well, there's the bit where, because Paul, obviously, after he's killed the professor and buried him in his own private crypt, and someone comes up to him and goes, thanks for letting the professor... You know he didn't have any family, don't you?
Yes, thanks I know. Thanks for letting him in. I know quite well.
Lie in your own crypt.
He's like, no problem. We appreciate you burying him in your crypt in your house. That's very nice of you.
But Cushion's so straight about everything, it's so serious, isn't it? That's why
he's
so
got
brilliant.
Like one track mind, he doesn't care about anything else, especially not about poor Josephine.
We've realized now that he's a complete sociopath, Cushion, in this, isn't he?
Yeah,
which is different from all the other Frankenstein stuff. He's not evil, but in this, he's a complete
he's mad. He's absolutely
he's
mad
just
out
set
mind.
On one thing. His mind's set on one thing. He doesn't care about anybody else. He's got no empathy for anybody else at all, does he? Nothing.
He doesn't even, when the monsters comes to life, the creature comes to life, he's instantly like, oh fucking hell. in other stories, he tries to be like a father to him, which is where that comes in the original book and stuff, you know.
In the book he rejects him straight away because he sees that he's hideous. That's like part of the thing. Doesn't try and But so there's that kind of thing as well. But he completely just sort of rejects him because he's like obviously ugly and stuff like that. So I guess that is similar to the book. I think definitely.
He's got a blue face.
He's got a blue face. Dead flesh. That's what I would say.
Blue face, but he's got quite a mop top going on and a lovely jacket when he's out and about.
I don't know where he gets the jacket from.
How does he put it on? Where does he get it from?
I've got no idea. But it's a good look. He's a good Frankenstein, isn't he? I read that Christopher Lee was a mime. So, like, he did a bit of mime and stuff like that. So, and he's a massive guy. He's a massive guy and stuff like that. And he only got the part because he was £2 cheaper than, you know, the big guy off the Carry On films.
Bernard Breslau.
Yeah, it was between Christopher Lee and him.
Really?
But Christopher Lee was £2 a day cheaper. So that's how he got the the job and stuff like that, which is mad.
He's brilliant. He's brilliant.
He is. And sinister and frightening. I mean, there's the bit where he does escape and he meets the old man in the forest where this is quite a blind man. Yeah. With this is quite a tender thing in the book and stuff. The blind man, because he can't see him, becomes his friend and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But not in this. He just murders him straight away. So this is just straight horror, isn't it? That's all it is.
Yeah, and it is.
Frankenstein's evil. Yeah. Peter Cushing's worse. So they're both evil, aren't they? Yeah. It's just a straight up horror. Yeah. Completely straight up horror. But yeah, I mean, and there's a bit with a reveal, which is, I think is important. The reveal of the monster where he thinks that he needs Paul for the experiment to succeed or whatever. And the lightning hits his machinery and just starts it up anyway.
Yeah.
And he kind of opens the door and it's super fast under his face. And Christopher Lee kind of rips the bandages off.
Yeah. It looks like it's sped up or something.
It looks sped up, yeah. But it's effective. Like, it's absolutely class. I love
that. Yeah. Pulls it off and he has got a hideous blue face.
he does.
And then essentially after that, there's just a bit of like the monster's just out and about, like causing bother.
He is. Well, he's out and about until Cushing and Victor Frankenstein and Paul hunt him down with rifles and shoot him right in the face.
Yeah, shoot him in the face. He has to have a bit of his head shaved and they chain him up again. And he teaches him like a dog, doesn't he? He's like, he goes, oh, watch this. Sit up, get up, sit down.
Yeah, he treats him like an animal, doesn't he? In a hideous way and stuff like that.
What do you think, like, Victor's thinking at this point? Because I think this is a bit that's kind of missing, unless I just didn't pay attention to it. But, like, he's done it. It hasn't turned out like he wanted. I don't know what he feels.
Yeah, I don't think he feels much of anything, does he? He just wants to keep sort of the creature alive so he can sort of experiment on him, and then when he's done with him, he'll destroy him, won't he?
Put him in the acid bath,
exactly. And then he'll do it again with another brain. There's a part where he does say, look, there's nothing that you can do to stop us. I'll just get another brain, and then I'll get another one, and then I'll get another one. So he's just relentless, and he's quest to create this perfect being, I guess, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And then
so he's not going to stop.
In the meantime, he is really horrible to the maid who thinks that he's going to marry her. She says she's pregnant, and he dumps her. And he just laughs at her, doesn't he?
Yeah, he laughs right in her face.
He's horrible, and then basically leaves her to be dealt with by the creature.
Exactly, he locks her in a room. And this whole setup is because he supposedly murdered the maid, hasn't he? You've got to remember, he's back telling the priest this, isn't he?
Yeah.
So, I just looked at in that room. By the way,
remember, this is me trying to tell you that I didn't kill her, but I did lock her in a room where the monster that I created could quite easily kill her.
And I've also killed the professor. Which I've previously only told you about. I
told you about that.
How does he expect to get out?
Well, I figured that I'll give him the crypt. That evens out.
I mean, how does he expect to get out?
It's as if, like, he's thinking, I'm not responsible. I didn't kill the fucking maid. Like, I'll get out. Like, that's the only thing he's thinking that he's got to prove. I didn't kill the fucking maid. But what I did do is steal the body and body parts of some dead people, kill your best brain.
But not the maid. I mean, you kind of get us with that one.
Can't get us with the maid. Listen to me, man.
even if the priest goes, all right, you didn't kill the maid, right? Fair enough. But we're charging you for the death of the professor, for sure. Can't get out of that one. You just confess.
And also, that's a maid that we don't really care about. This is Europe's best brain.
Exactly.
It's like,
far more important.
You're definitely going to come in for some stick for that. So after that, the monster gets out again. He rips his chains from the wall, gets on the roof.
gets on the roof, yes, and Elizabeth goes up there because Victor Frankenstein's preoccupied with Paul, who's threatened to bring the villagers into all this.
Yeah, I'll get the villagers involved.
I'm getting the villagers now. But they couldn't put that bit in because, again, that's in the Universal bit, yeah, isn't it? That, you know, famous bit with villagers and pitchforks stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they couldn't have that. But, yeah, so he's on the roof and he grabs Elizabeth and stuff like that. And Cushion, in his mad brain, shoots his betrothed, doesn't he?
There's another murder.
Well, she's not actually dead. I thought she was dead.
But yeah, no, but she appears at the end. Paul, right, quite rightly, steals her. I think.
So he's not a very good shot cushion, is he?
No, he doesn't hit her. But it's enough to spook the monster, who falls through the roof into the vat of acid.
Well, he chucks the fire on him first, doesn't he? And that's what gets him. And he's straight in the acid, that's right. So there's no evidence that the creature ever existed because he's dissolved in the acid or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then obviously Paul at the end comes to visit him and stuff like that. And he's saying, Paul, tell them it's all true. Tell them it was
the monster that I created that killed the maid, not me.
And yeah.
He doesn't say anything. He just stares up into the ceiling.
So, yeah, he's sent to the guillotine. Isn't he?
Paul's definitely with Elizabeth at this point.
He's moved in there, hasn't he? So an opportunity.
I'm presuming he hasn't told Elizabeth of his part in the beginning of this story.
Yeah, he's quite culpable, isn't he?
I mean, he taught him how to do it.
He taught him how to do all this stuff in the first place. But yeah, I mean, I think it's great. What did you think of the film? Did you enjoy it?
I did. That's enjoy what it's about. I did enjoy it. Like it's only 80 minutes long or something like that. It's enjoyable. There is a bit in the middle where I think it sags a bit. Actually, it takes ages before the fucking monster gets into it.
Yeah, 40 minutes.
And the monster doesn't really do much when he is there. So it is more about Victor Frankenstein, I think, which is all the better for it because Peter Cushing's fantastic in it. Like, he has been in everything I've seen him in. So as a like scene setter for Hammer, or for Hammer to take on a series of Frankenstein films and stuff like that, I think brilliant. It isn't the story that, or it isn't the exact story that people know from Frankenstein or might expect. But yeah, I think The Curse of Frankenstein, I think that's a weird title for it.
Yeah, well, again, they weren't allowed to just call it Frankenstein, so they had to, you know, come up with something else and stuff like that. But yeah, no, I don't mind. I like all the titles and things like that. I love, that's part of the reasons why I love
it. I like them, but I don't think it's got anything to do with the film.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, to be perfectly honest. But I mean, this kind of birthed Hammer in a horror sense and stuff like that, because they've done films before that, the Quater Mass Experiment and stuff like that, which is also amazing, was before this, but that's more science fiction-y.
Yeah.
But don't really talk about money and stuff like that, but I think it cost 65 grand to make this film. 65 English pounds. And it in just America, it made like 8 million or something like that, because you can see how, you know, what so a hit these, it was.
The Hammer films did well in America, did they?
Massive in America.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was just watching a documentary there with Martin Scorsese on, who was talking about like lining up to go and watch all the Hammer horror films and stuff like that when he was a kid, and just loving them because they were in colour, they were like gory and things that they would shock you. I think that's what he said.
Yeah, I think it would. And the blood is a very like specific blood, isn't it? Thick, like red.
Very colour. Red, isn't it? Yeah.
Is also definitely being used in like the Italian horror films of the 70s, and also Scorsese in some of his early films. I think the blood's looks similar.
The other interesting thing for me doing this was finding out the people who brought like the script to Hammer in the first place was Max Rosenberg and Milton Subotsky, who we've talked about before, you might be able to remember. So they took the script to Hammer, and they said, well, we're not going to do that script or whatever, but they brought them the idea. So they got paid like a finder's fee. Okay. And they were pretty pissed off that they brought the idea to Hammer and stuff
Okay,
that.
Okay.
So then they went off and made Amicus. That's their company. Because they were pissed off. Yeah. So it's like the birth of Hammer Horror and the rivals Amicus as well at the same time.
Talking about Scorsese, I did watch one other thing. I watched The Card Counter, Paul Schrader's latest film that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago.
Good.
If you like Paul Schrader, and Scorsese produces it, if you like Paul Schrader films, then you'll love it. Oscar Isaac is absolutely amazing in it. And I think Paul Schrader is one of those filmmakers where almost every film is almost the same. It's very Taxi Driver. You know, he's always got a kind of lone man who's battling with something, and he narrates it and all of that. Very, very good. Very good. I would recommend it.
Ooh. Yeah, I mean,
but would you like a quiz?
Oh, would indeed. It's what I live for.
Going down, and I might not be able to read it in 5 minutes. So, this quiz is about other Frankensteins, actors who've played Frankenstein's monster or the creature.
Okay.
We're going to talk about Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, Peter Boyle, Randy Quaid, and Aaron Eckhart. Okay.
Ooh, what
all excellent actors. So first off, Boris Karloff first played Frankenstein's monster in 1931. Played him many, many times. So outside of horror films, he kind of had a life of his own as Boris Karloff because of his legacy as he got later in life. He plays a major part in a festive film or special that I know you like. Do you know which one it is? It's from 1966.
It's 1966. It's not Christmas Carol, is it?
It's not. He is the narrator in The Grinch Who Stole Christmas.
I haven't seen that. I've seen the Jim Carrey film.
Yeah, yeah, of course. But he's the narrator of the animated one from 1966, with Boris Karloff.
Lugosi hated Karloff, didn't he?
Yes, so next up is Bela Lugosi, who says that was overstated a bit, but I think he does think, if only I'd got to play Frankenstein first, that would have been me, instead of being in Ed Wood films instead.
Instead of being Dracula.
Bela Lugosi is more known for being Dracula, but he did play him in 1943, and it's in God Created a Werewolf or something like that. It's the first one where there's like a werewolf and there's Frankenstein and there's Dracula and all of that.
Yeah.
So he's in that in 1943. So he's better known as Dracula. Do you know what he did when he died?
Just rested.
Just rested, yeah.
Did he get buried in his Dracula?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he got buried in his Dracula
costume.
Kid. Yeah.
Yes, I knew that from Ed Wood, I think.
All right. Okay.
I'm sure moving that's on in there.
To the brilliant Peter Boyle, who also Taxi Driver. He's in that.
Yeah.
He's in loads of stuff. He's such a great character actor. He died a few years ago. But he played Frankenstein in, for a start, do you know what he played Frankenstein's monster in?
Young Frankenstein?
Yeah, 1974. But your question is, there's a Beatles link. Do you know what it is?
Oh, well, Boyle is also the name of the art. No, that's not true. No, go on, give us it.
John Lennon was his best man in 1977.
Was he?
Yeah, they became friends when Lennon was kind of on his lost weekend. And as he moved back to New York, Peter Boyle married a Rolling Stone photographer. And that's how they kind of became friends. And John Lennon was his best man when they got married.
That's interesting. That's good. He also is in what's it called? Where the geese fly or something like that.
Where the wild geese fly.
That's it.
Or where the wild geese roam, is it?
Run somewhere like that anyway with Bill Murray as that. So that I haven't really watched that film though. I don't know if you have. Is it any good?
I don't think I have. I've seen lots of stuff with him in. I think he's brilliant. He's superb in Taxi Driver.
Yeah. It's like Hunter S. Thompson film, isn't it?
Yeah, and also I think if you don't know who he is from any of that, he's the dad in Everybody Loves Raymond. Is what he was.
I'm not big on these sitcoms or anything.
No,
like
but
that,
people listening might know more from that.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so now we're on to the mad as fuck Randy Quaid, who played Frankenstein in 1992 in a film called Frankenstein. I've never seen this. I've got no idea anything about it. He's obviously mad, but he was arrested. And in it got acquitted for him, and I think it got thrown out for him, and I think his wife got the case got dismissed against her when it got to court. But they were arrested on charges of burglary in 2010, I think. Do you know this story? This is the question.
I do. I think I've asked you a question about it before. Is it the way he said that there was people going around who were celebrity stealing or something like that? People's identities.
It's not, but there is something like that. There's quite a few stories that kind of interlink because he was just in trouble for a lot for a few years. This one is he basically moved into his old house that he didn't live in anymore and somebody else owned. And because he said like the sale wasn't proper, so he just wanted to go back into it.
He's a proper nutcase, isn't he? He absolutely puts videos on Twitter that are mental and things, doesn't
he? He's a conspiracy theorist. He believes he's a Trump supporter. But, I mean, this is like years before that. He was obviously, he's a troubled man, whatever he's got going on in his life. But, so there's a few mad stories where he's been arrested for crazy things like this. He ran away to Canada to try and get into there and stay
there. To get away from the celebrity stalker people who'd killed Heath Ledger.
Yeah, but he didn't have the rights to stay in Canada, so he got into trouble for that over and over again. So that's Randy Quaid. Lastly is Aaron Eckhart, who I don't know whether I think Aaron Eckhart's good or bad, because some stuff I think he's really shit in, but I think Thank You for Not Smoking, I think he's excellent in.
He's good Two-Face.
Yeah,
in The Dark Knight,
he gets a lot of stick for that, but I think
I don't think he should.
The essence of his character was obviously part of the hour that got cut, I think, because he's like in it. Then when he becomes Two-Face, it's pretty much the end of the film, isn't it? Like, he's
I still like him as Two-Face. Me, like, I thought he was good. I thought he was good.
Yeah, but yeah, I think he's good.
I have seen the Frankenstein film that he's in as well, which isn't very good.
That's from 2004.
Frankenstein.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
No, it's not very good.
Well, he kind of jobbed around for a lot of years, and Thank You for Not Smoking was this film that kind of got his name out there, which is quite a serious kind of dark comedy. He's good in it, but he almost made it when he was just pipped at the post by Guy Pearce for a role. Do you know what film that was?
Guy Pearce, was it Memento?
Yeah, it is. He was almost played Leonard, whatever he's called. Leonard Shelby, is it?
Something like that. Well, I'm glad Guy Pearce got it. Yes, me too.
That's the end of the quiz.
A bit better than Aaron Eckhart.
I think you got 8 out of 5 there, so well done.
That's good. That's a very good score, isn't it? It's a lot higher than I was expecting.
That's good, eight out of five. Well done, you. So we've got music. Do you want to tell everyone what it is?
Yeah, so we've got some electronic music, which me and you thoroughly enjoy, don't we?
Yes,
we enjoy the electronic music floating through our minds. Mm-hmm. From Michael Donahue with London, that's what it's called. And it's from the LP of the same name as well. And it's out now.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like it. It's good.
And me too. So everybody enjoy this as it strikes up. Yeah. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for good horror stuff. Hammer, great fun as always. And thank you to Michael Donahue for landing. Here it is. We'll speak to you next time. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.